From 1984, Smuggler's Blues by Glenn Frey, an appropriate segue to our next segment. Organized crime doesn't look today the way it looked back in the era just described by Bill Friedman in the first half of tonight's program. These days it comes in many forms, many guises. Prohibition may be gone, but another form of prohibition remains, and it offers a chance for organized crime to earn billions of dollars per year, and specifically, I mean, the illegal drug trade. My next guest is investigative reporter and author Toby Rogers, who gained special access to a modern mob run by a man who goes by the nickname the Ganja Godfather. That's the title of Toby's new book. How did he get this guy to open up and tell all about how a drug empire is run these days? We'll hear that story right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Toby Rogers is an award-winning author, an investigative journalist who's written for the New York Times, New York Post, Village Voice, High Times, and other media outlets. His new book, The Ganja Godfather, The Untold Story of New York City's Weed Kingpin, is a unique look into a current ongoing criminal enterprise. Toby, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, George.
I guess the amazing part is you got to report on something that's still underway. It's not like Bill Friedman we had in the first half of the program. It's a great book, but it's about stuff that's basically done. Yours is still going on.
Right. Well, the Ganja Godfather is not a jailhouse memoir or an old dead man's tale. It's unique in the true crime genre for that reason. It is about an ongoing criminal operation, which is going on right now. Run by the Ganja Godfather, a.k.a. Silvio Ebley, who runs the Ebley crime family in New York.
So that's the part I could not understand, is why someone in his line of work would embrace this kind of an expose, where you really do lay it out.
That's an excellent question, George. I honestly believe that Silvio is probably blinded by pure narcissism. You know, over the summer, last summer, in Europe, Sicilian, dynasties, some sons had taken over from the fathers, and they were flaunting their yachts and gold chains and girls on Facebook, and the European media dubbed them the Facebook Mafia. And Silvio, and that maybe parallels in the, I guess these guys want to be mythologized like their predecessors were, only they want to be alive when it's going on. So in a way, the fascination with the mafia, Italian mafia in particular, with Hollywood, I believe Silvio Ebley too is entranced and wants to be mythologized in that vein.
Silvio Ebley is not his real name?
No.
Okay, can somebody figure it out, though? Isn't it, I mean, it would seem to be, if he really is from that family, somebody could figure out how he fits together in it.
Well, I'm sure there might be a few people that could figure it out close hand, but I tried to really protect the sources for this book in order to publish it. It was pretty tricky, and it took me about 5 years to really get the narrative right, and it also included an editing job by Silvio himself, who had to approve every line of the book.
Sure, that would make sense. That would be the kind of deal you'd make. I thought your style was reminded me a lot of Hunter S. Thompson, and that, I mean, you're pretty blunt about blunts and about your own life and things you do in your own time.
So, thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
Let's start this way. One reason that you got such incredible access to Silvio and his operations, because you've known him for so long, basically all of your life. Tell me how the relationship begins, at what point, how old you are.
You know, I met him actually in a fish store in Westchester County that his family was running. They had split with the Genovese crime family when their patriarch Tommy Ebley was assassinated in 1972. Who ran the Genovese crime family as boss from 1969 to 1972, and they kind of set up their own family organization, independent from the five families. They had a cut of Fulton Fish Market, and they set up some fish markets in around New York City, Bronx, and in Westchester County, and I happened to walk by, so I helped wanted sign, and I met Silvio in the back of the fish store. He ended up going to high school together, coincidentally, and it was that's how it all started, and I actually met a lot of interesting people through the through this time period. And when I went off to college, Silvio was muling weed from Jamaica, from back and forth from Kingston to New York. And eventually, when Rudy Giuliani took over as mayor, he cracked down on the street dealing in New York. And that was really when the rise of the home delivery marijuana business began. And
we'll come back to that. Let's talk about the fish market for a bit. Was it really a fish market, or was it something else, or was it both?
I had to. It was a little. It was involving fish.
They were selling fish, but was it as a cover for something else, or was
no? It was just they had a. I think they were getting fish for free from the market, and they were selling it cash only. And you know, it was that's how it all began with them. They actually had to. They moved to Westchester County after Patsy Silvio had New York State had officially declared him dead after 7 years and issued a death certificate, and they were able to liquidate all his assets. And then they moved up to Westchester County and from Fort Lee, New Jersey. And that's where I started my interactions with them. I actually met the whole family at a Christmas party in 1984.
Right. We're going to get into the whole family and the history, because that's some of the best stuff. I mean, their position in the mafia is just a pretty amazing. I mean, they're major players.
Right.
Back to how you got started there. At some point, you're working at this fish market. I think it comes over you. Hey, something smells funny here, and it's not just the fish.
Right. Well, you know, I went over to their house Christmas Eve, and I saw the line of Cadillacs outside the house, and there were they had engraved initials on the cars, and the drivers or the owners of that car had the same initials on their sweatsuits. There was a lot of gold chains, gold watches, tons of Italian food, and a really shady poker game going on in the basement. And it did dawn on me, the cash-only fish stores. I just thought something was suspicious about it all. Although, I guess at that time, I felt a little guilty. It seemed like I was falling into a vicious Italian stereotype as well.
What do you mean?
Well, it's just,
these guys have gold
chains. Mafia based on the clothes they wear and the way they act. I felt maybe I was being prejudiced, coming from Scarsdale and not really seeing that type of been in that type of environment before, but they were pretty mobbed up family.
so my
intuition was right.
Share with me how the peels of the onion start coming off. How Silvio reveals to you what's really going on. How you learn what the operation is. As his operation grows.
Well, honestly, actually, it was all under my nose, a lot of it. I had my suspicions, but it was never really revealed to me until the fall of 2009. And what had happened was Mark Jacobs of New York Magazine had approached Silvio about a profile in New York Magazine. And I guess what ended up being published was not what Silvio really wanted. It was just kind of a long, epic story about marijuana in New York. It did mention Silvio as Francis. But he wasn't really too pleased with the article overall, and so he contacted me to reboot the whole story, and that's how it all started. And then, really from there, I found out everything about the history of the Ebley family, and its extraordinary tale and connections with the rise of the mafia in New York.
Well, let's go to that part right now. We'll come back to Silvio. Tommy and Patsy, as you mentioned, I mean, these are major players. How talk about their rise, how they came up in the family, and how high they went.
Well, Tommy, as I said before, was boss of the Ebley family from 1969 to 1972, brothers with Patsy Ebley. They started early in the 1930s, very young, started bootlegging liquor for Vito Genovese and Lucky Luciano in New York City. And when Prohibition ended, Tommy Ebley was a professional boxer, and they moved into fight fixing from there. And then Tommy got into management. And that's really where they made extraordinary amount of money. Fight fixing was a really great racket for the mafia during World War II, right after Prohibition. And it was really, according to Patsy and the family, when a fixed fight was done, it just rained money. It was the easiest. It was the easiest racket in New York.
So one of the brothers, it was a Tommy, I think, that he became infamous in boxing in that he thought he had a fixed fight, and it turned out that it was fixed the other way, and he went into the ring. Tell that story.
Oh, yeah, that was an infamous night in boxing history, sports history, and I think historians would say it was probably the worst thing that happened in boxing history up till Mike Tyson chewed Evander Holyfield's ear off. But in January 11th, 1952, in Madison Square Garden, Tommy Ebley had arranged a fixed fight with his fighter, and it was supposed to be a victory for him. And what happened was, in the sixth round, the fighter that was supposed to lose ended up knocking down Tommy's fighter. In the seventh round, it was knocked down again, and the referee called a pretty shady TKO, and that's when Tommy realized that the fix was on him. And from what I was told from family, he was went into almost slow motion, and looked at his brother Patsy in the front row, and slipped through the ropes, and he KO'd the referee, Arthur Miller. And he got a standing ovation, and popcorn and peanuts and beer were flying all over the place as he walked out back to the locker room, where he ended up attacking the promoter of the fight too, for betraying him. And he was arrested, actually, a few days later for assault, and ended up in jail for a few months after that.
When you consider all the things that he and his brother must have done in their life, it's amazing that that they didn't do more jail time. But you make the point early in the book. You said about, you know, how there's all these mob documentaries that are on TV and shown on the History Channel, and these guys' names never seem to show up. Why not?
Well, they don't fit the mold that Uncle Sam likes for their, mafia mythology, which is that they always get busted or killed in the end. And Patsy Ebley really goes against that grain. He's probably one of the only mob figures that actually got away with everything. He was not arrested once his entire life. There's not one mugshot of him, no charges. And he ended up escaping at the end of his life back to Sicily. And lived a nice quiet life in the rural hills of Sicily.
What were the rackets? What did these guys do when they're young men coming up in the organization?
Well, Tommy, he was actually a bodyguard for Vito Genovese, and that's how he started. Prior to that, they were bootlegging liquor around New York, but Lucky Luciano and Vito Genovese met him at a fight, and they quickly moved him into the inner circle. And Vito Genovese had him also as a hired hitman as well as Lucky Luciano. So Tommy was involved in a lot of historical killings. Dutch Schultz comes to mind. That's actually nobody really knows who did that, but according to the family, it was Tommy Ebley and a crew that killed him in Newark in 1934. As well as just dozens of other people. He was a regular hitman all the way up till he was even front boss for Vito Genovese while he was in jail. Tommy liked to do killings. He was when he did it, he did it himself, and that happened also again in 1966 when he took out a Salvatore Granello, who was a known child molester, who Tommy just personally hated and wanted to take him out, and he finally did it when he became boss. So that was another thing that they did, and a lot of the Bonnies they would drive up West 17, which is now I guess Old West 17, up to the Catskills. They get off at the Swan Lake exit. They would take gym weights and bags, and they would take the Bonnie and they would throw it in the lake. And it was again never got caught. It's a pretty amazing thing. Tommy Ebley. Yes.
We'll come back to Swan Lake later because it plays a role in this story later on. Mm-hmm. You said, I think one of the hits that you attribute to Tommy was, I mean, it's a major deal in the history of the mafia and how things played out. It was in 1931. It's Lucky Luciano having dinner with another big boss. Tell that story.
Well, that was after a huge bloodbath that was going on for the year prior when. I guess the roots of the Sicilian gangs or mafia wanted to take over the bootlegging operation in New York, and Lucky Luciano was underboss for an individual that was warring with the Sicilian mob at the time. They went and I guess, cut a deal. Luciano cut a deal with the Sicilian Mafia. But then again, he turned on them, suspecting that he was going to be killed. And then that's really when Lucky Luciano took over. And that's also when you see the formation of the commission and the heads of the five families. There was coordinated originally by the Sicilians when they took over. They tried to recreate the rural Sicilian mafia hierarchy. They transported it to New York, and they split up the families into five separate pieces. And then because of all the warring factions, Lucky Luciano decided he didn't want that anymore, so he set up the commission. And each head of the family would meet, and they would discuss matters. And if there was any disputes, so they would also forge alliances with each other and chart their future together.
You touched briefly on the death of Dutch Schultz, and of course that's one of the most famous mob hits of all time, and everybody's got different theories on who did it. I mean, I figured it was mobsters, but they never were quite sure who it is. Mm. You're pretty sure you know who it is.
Well, Lucky Luciano ordered the hit, that's for certain. And when you conclude, you know, Tom, of course the family knew about that as always. And if Tommy and Patsy spent considerable amount of time in Catskills looking for the lost treasure of Dutch Schultz. After Tommy made the hit, they found out that Schultz had ordered a custom-built waterproof safe, and that he had stuffed $7 million in cash and bonds in it somewhere in the Catskills. And of course, Luciano, the brothers Eboli, and Vito Genovese spent a considerable amount of time looking for this safe, and they never found it. And till this day, people meet in the Catskills every year and try to look for the lost treasure of Dutch Schultz.
Huh. Why did Dutch Schultz have to go? Do you know?
He wanted to knock out, he wanted to whack Thomas Dewey, who was U.S. Special Attorney, looking into the mob in New York. And Dewey was investigating Schultz, and Schultz was the kingpin of the restaurant racket. And it was constantly burning down, basically opening up restaurants and then liquidating them and taking all the goods and borrowing as much money as you can and then finally burning it down for the insurance money. That was his racket. And, of course, Dewey was looking into that. Schultz had appealed to the commission and Lucky Luciano to take out Dewey. They thought it was a very bad idea and refused the offer. Schultz went to converted to Catholicism from Judaism to get Luciano to change his mind. And there was a second meeting that took place to clarify Luciano's position, which again was thoroughly rejected. And that's when Schultz decided he was going to go kill Dewey anyway. So he actually announced it to the commission that he was going to do it anyway. When Schultz went rogue, Luciano decided that it was time to take him out. And that's when they got in touch with Tommy, and that's when they hit him in October of 1934 in the Newark, New Jersey bar.
And I guess there was a point Tommy also brought Luciano a request from Vito Genovese to whack Frank Costello. It was another name that we mentioned in the last half of the show. These are big names. It doesn't seem like it's a good idea to be the mob boss back in those days.
Right, your short-lived lives. Lucky Luciano was deported, and I guess lived a longer life than most. But he was really on the top of the food chain in the pyramid of the mafia. So being boss is really you got a target on your head.
Here was something that was a real surprise to me, and we'll get into this after the break. But Vincent the Chin Gigante, I didn't know he'd been a boxer for Tommy, and some of the things that you attribute to him in this book, I've never read before anywhere. We'll get into that with my guest Toby Rogers, author of The Ganja Godfather, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Sort of a romantic ode to pot smugglers from Jimmy Buffett. It's A Pirate Looks at 40 from 1974, a quintessential Buffett album, A1A. We're talking with Toby Rogers, author of The Ganja Godfather, about his insights learned from Silvio, one of the leading marijuana smugglers and dealers in New York City. When we come back, we're going to jump right into how this operation works and how Toby got such an inside look at it. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Toby, one more story about sort of the good old days, and then we'll update it here and get to more modern times. You mentioned in the book something I'd never heard in all the mob books I've read about Vincent the Chin Gigante, who was, I guess, a boxer and then became a hitman for the Eboli's. Tell me the story.
Right. Well, Vincent, known as Vincent the Chin Gigante, started out as a boxer under Tommy's corner or under his wing, and he also became, I guess, a hitman for the mob as well. Tommy actually, the only hit that Tommy didn't take personally was Frank Costello, and for that he asked Vincent to pull the trigger. He dropped Vincent off at Tommy's apartment building. Vincent waited in the lobby. He took one shot at Frank in the head. Frank Costello fell to the ground. Vincent ran out and said he hit him in the head, but it only grazed Frank. But it also achieved what Tommy and Vito Genovese wanted, which is to take Frank Costello out of power. So there was actually a really amazing meeting that took place in upstate New York, where hundreds of mobsters from all over the United States, Canada, and Italy showed up, and Frank Costello handed power over to Vito Genovese, and Tommy Eboli became underboss for Vito Genovese right there.
Tommy becomes acting boss at some point. You say that, I guess the official version, the assumption is that his brother, Patsy, was murdered and dumped somewhere. You sh have a different story in this book.
Right. Patsy actually escaped to Sicily. According to the family, they hired a private investigator to find out what happened, and what they discovered was that Patsy Eboli went and got a one-way ticket to Lagos, Nigeria. He drove himself to JFK, put the keys in the glove box, parked it in long-term parking, brought out new luggage and brand new clothes, and hopped on his plane from there. From Nigeria, he made his way through Africa up to Tunisia, and then got on a boat to Sicily, where he remained to his. I guess we don't know what happened to him at the end, but if he was alive today, he would be 91 years old.
Your friend Silvio apparently had sort of Hollywood royalty in his home because of the nature of what his family did for a living. While the movie The Godfather was being done, all these folks ended up in the Eboli house. How did that come about?
Well, Al Letteri, sister Jean Letteri ended up marrying Patsy Eboli, and Al Letteri, as you know, was played Virgil the Turk Salazzo in The Godfather. He actually had to ask permission to play that role from Tommy Eboli, who was boss at the time, and.
But why? Why was he? Are you saying that he was sort of under his thumb, or worked for him, or what?
No, not I just. I think maybe it would have maybe been considered disrespectful if he had
Right.
not asked. I think it was just more of a courtesy. It was a mob movie. His sister-in-law was married to Patsy Eboli,
Oh, I see.
so it was just kind of a courtesy. Of course, Tommy was very enthusiastic about him taking the role, but then Al ended up bringing over several members of the cast and Al Roddy, the producer, over to the Eboli house in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And Sylvia was there in a crib. He was just born about a few weeks prior, and so yeah, it was a in the mafia world, the night that the cast of The Godfather and the real Genovese crime family broke bread is really a legendary in mafia circles.
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine otherwise. I mean, Al Pacino, James Caan,
Right.
you said Albert Ruddy, they all showed up, and then they had, I guess they ended up getting tips from the real thing about how mobsters were to operate.
Right, they got a real taste or the flavor of the mafia, and that was one of the reasons why they went over there. Patsy Eboli actually ended up helping Al Pacino and Al Letteri do the Italian speak Italian in Lou's restaurant. That scene where Al Pacino shoots the police chief and the and I guess Patsy's brother-in-law, the Virgil the Turk, when they get hit. That whole scene is a lot of that dialogue is done in Italian, and actually, Patsy Eboli spent several days with Al Pacino, both Al's, practicing their Italian for that scene. Patsy Eboli was actually on the set for that shot.
Well, your friend Silvio was, of course, too young to remember this stuff, but yeah, that's a great story to be able to tell when you get older. So the fish market thing, you work for them, you get to know them a little bit, then you go a separate way. You develop, you're working on your career. You bounce from newspaper to newspaper. Some of your descriptions, by the way, are really hilarious. I mean,
Oh,
of the
thank you.
people you work for, I can just imagine that. But it
Right.
was good training for you to learn how to be a journalist because it prepared you for this, right?
Absolutely. Well, actually, I think the sequence you're talking about actually happened after I was dealing
Oh.
with Silvio. I actually ended up on the lam for a little while after the
Yeah.
fall of 2009, and ended up working at a lot of small town papers in upstate New York and Berkshires. And yeah, there's some pretty crazy stories that go on these small town papers. And
So
yeah, what happened was that Silvio got robbed, and in the fall of 2009, I went to go get coffee around the corner. It was actually the night the Yankees won the World Series, and we had been up all night. And he asked me to go get some coffee. When I came back, I found him covered in blood and weed. And he was just robbed in between when I went to get coffee. And I went and grabbed his muscle next door on Silvio's orders. He was very calm during the situation. He told me to get his muscle next door. I knocked on the door, got him out of bed, and we brought him to White Plains Hospital that morning. And I decided, and Silvio said that he didn't believe I was safe at that point because he didn't know who did this. Wasn't sure if it was because word had gotten out that there was a journalist shadowing him. So he wasn't sure if it had anything relation to do with that. So therefore, I just proceeded to move upstate New York and ended up actually at Swan Lake, where all Tommy and Patsy's bodies used to get dumped, coincidentally.
tell me that the call or the conversation you have with Silvio the first time he asks you to do this assignment. I mean, there had to be second thoughts about doing this because of, there's some implied risk.
Of course. Well, I actually, that's the first thing that dawned on me when I was asked, is that I would wind up in a ditch somewhere because he'd have second thoughts about all of it. But he made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and really was able to. I told him I wasn't going to be his propaganda minister, and that I really wanted all access to everything, and he agreed to it, and so it went from there.
Did he tell you why he wanted it done? I mean, in his words, I mean, you have your own idea why he did it, but what did he say? Why would he
I
want?
believe that he, truthfully, he didn't say it verbatim, but he basically said he was hoping he could be mythologized like all his predecessors. He kind of considers himself the linear descendant of Lucky Luciano and the brothers Eboli, and he believes his story should be told just like any other famous mobster.
He did not rise in his profession because of the Eboli name, though. I mean, he sort of carved out his own territory step by step. Tell us about how the evolution of that business, how he carved out some territory for himself.
Well, he actually a lot of these scions from the mob, they don't want their sons or grandsons going into the family business necessarily. The hope is that if you're going to a school in Westchester County, you have an opportunity to go to college. You have an opportunity to get out of the and go legit. So he actually went against the grain of his family's wishes. And yes, he did cut out his own orbit of hustling. And it really just started at the bottom rung, muling weed from Jamaica back and forth, and it was starting in the late 80s.
Who was he working for?
He was working for a guy named Chico originally, and that's he would pay him cash for each trip. I think it was $4,000 for each trip. And then he started working for a guy named the Chief, who was in the Irish mob, and he was working for the Irish mob when the home delivery business began.
And just carry, he would just, as he's a smuggling, he just carries it in on his person.
They would
He
vacuum seal it and tape it to his legs, his thighs and shins.
Wow, that's pretty risky.
Sometimes the mules will hire other mules too, is another way they do it. So,
You describe in the book at one point where he did get caught,
yes,
with a big pile.
right. That was actually the largest. That was the largest mule operation he ever did. It was a crazy weight. It was 10 pounds, and that's an absurd amount of weight. But I guess the chief or his boss wanted it, needed it, because they had some fits and starts over the summer, and they're worried about the holiday season coming up. This was the summer of 2001, and he taped ten. They him and a girl taped 10 pounds of ganja to his legs, And he got through Kingston Airport fine, but when he hit JFK, he got busted. And what they did was is they just booted him out the back door and kept the bud. He had to tell his boss, I got busted in at JFK, but they let me out the back door.
They just did, they didn't charge him. That's astonishing to me.
It is. And, you know, I don't know if that's a family connection thing. I never was able to figure that out. I think they just wanted to keep the weed. This was pre-9/11 as well, too. So
when he comes back to his boss, the chief, and says, hey, I got busted, but I didn't get arrested, I imagine the boss is thinking you stole the weed.
There was quite suspicion swirling around Silvio at that time. But before anyone could really do anything about it, 9/11 happened. And their office, including a safe with a lot of bud in it, was buried in debris. So that really was when the marijuana delivery business in New York fractured, was that brief time period after 9/11. And that's actually when Silvio decided to take over, because he was able, when people moved back, Silvio moved in. And he really created a real niche for himself post 9/11.
All right, describe it, the marijuana delivery business, because this was amazing to me. But I mean, it was fairly common, and people would just deliver on bicycles.
You call up
on the phone and get it delivered.
That's post Giuliani or pre or during Giuliani's mayorship. He basically pushed it out of the parks, where you could go to Washington Square Park or Thompson Square Park and buy little bags of weed for 10 or 20 bucks. Usually dime bags is what they were called, and that got destroyed. So what emerged after that was the home delivery business, and what people from all over New York would get on these lists, and dealers, they would call the dealer. The dealer would send out a bike messenger to that address with several strains in a backpack, and the customer would decide which box he was going to buy. Usually for $50, it was a couple of grams in each box.
Silvio learned that he was pretty good at this, right?
He's a natural. I don't know if it's genetic or what, but he has a personal touch with his delivery business, and that's really what it is. It's customer service, and you're going into people's homes. And growing up in Westchester County, he kind of had an edge over a lot of the other criminals in the underworld. He had a sophistication to him that a lot of New Yorkers picked up on. He was introduced to Chris Farley at a party, Chris Farley introduced him to several members and cast of the Saturday Night Live cast. And he built a celebrity base in New York that thrives to this day.
The events of 9/11 change everything for him, as you mentioned, and then something else happens. Somebody starts robbing, I think it's in sequence, starts robbing bicycle messengers, and that sort of leads him to help consolidate his business, right?
Right. Well, the robberies began in started on July 4th of 2001 when he was working for the chief. But he was continually robbed. It happens every few years, at least until he discovered who the whole plot behind it. But while I was shadowing him in 2009, he had no idea who it was, and that's one of the reasons why I ended up going upstate for a while. And he actually hid in the island of Tobago for the holidays, and he opened shop again after the new year, but it was very low key. He barely spent any time in New York.
As you describe in the book, somebody had figured out how to intercept the communications of the bicycle messengers so they'd know where they were.
Right. Well, there might have been somebody on the inside who was working for them. It was really hard to tell. It happened so quickly. But that was really the first time the chief shut down that summer, and that started the problems with his delivery business. And actually, that's one of the reasons why Sylvia was to take over. He'd memorized the list because the list, as I said before, These are sold between dealers for hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes, and he was able to obtain it for free after 9/11.
There was an incident you describe in the book that I have it vividly in my head. It's where all the bicycle messengers decide to convene at one place to talk about these robberies, and they're confronted.
Yeah. They meet in Astor Place, and Silvio, they're trying to figure a way out. Silvio says, hey, we're going to shoot down St. Mark Street, and we're going to run through Thompson Square. We're going to split up there, and then we're all going to meet back at McSorley's, which is right back where they were at Astor Place. So they shot down St. Mark Street. It was actually on the 4th of July. Fireworks were shooting up overhead. They split through Central Park or Thompson Square Park, met back at McSorley's and escaped the that night. It was a pretty clever way to get away from New York and reorganize your team.
So talk about the dollar figures at that point of his life. How much weed he's selling in a day or a typical week or something like that, and then what the profits were for the organization, and then compare that to where it goes later.
Well, he was earning $250 cash per day for biking around the city with marijuana. I would guess he'd probably sell anywhere between 10 to 15, 20 boxes each day at that time. By the end now in 2013, he is, well, actually has a whole new travel package, which is amazing, we can talk about, which I wasn't able to talk about in the book because it just started, and Silvio talked to me about it recently. But he buys grams from California wholesale. Well, not grams, he buys 100-pound blocks, but gram price-wise, he gets them for about $5, $6, and he ends up flipping them back in the city market for $30 a gram. And you have to, just to get in the door, you have to buy 3 2-gram tickets, which ends up to $180. And so it's an incredible profit margin on his part. And one of the main reasons why it's his central hustle in New York.
It's gigantic then, huh?
Right. Yes, it is. And he has a significant a monopoly of downtown New York, as well as the Upper West Side, which he recently took over about in the fall of 2013.
You mentioned about Chris Farley and other celebrities, and then I guess Silvio is smooth enough that he travels in those circles, or he did then, and he still does now.
Absolutely. He has quite a number of people in the entertainment business, music business, that buy exclusively from Silvio in New York, professional athletes in basketball, hockey, football. He does not have any in baseball. Even when the players get traded to other teams and they're all over the country, he FedExes weed to them exclusively. And it's Silvio's personal touch. He's actually good friends with a lot of these people, and I actually met several celebrities while tailing him.
I can't imagine that this guy, the chief, was really happy about it. First about the loss of 10 pounds from Jamaica, and then Silvio branching out into his own business and taking a big chunk of the city with him. This chief guy, I would think, would hold a grudge.
He did, and there were death threats were made. Several recordings, voicemails that I got from Silvio gave me, and also some recordings that he had from other people that were kind of quietly working for him on the lowdown, I guess. Recording all of the chief's rants, and I have transcripts of them running through the book. And he was livid about what had happened. But at the end, there was, no matter what he did, there was nothing he could do, because the customer sided with Silvio at that point. And that's when the chief lost his list and lost control of the whole situation. And Silvio really just took it right under his nose.
I'd be curious, and we'll get into this, whether it's a business that's so lucrative, whether or not there's violence, such as in the old days of the mob, whether you got to be on the lookout for that, and I can imagine what the answer is. And then we'll get into the Bernie Madoff story. Much more here to come here with Toby Rogers and his book, The Ganja Godfather, after this on Coast to Coast.